your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are. Grass make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
I'm George Butler. To my right with me this afternoon in Dallas, Texas at the JFK Conference 2017 is Jim Fetzer. My gosh, I can't say a good enough, introduction for Jim Fetzer. He's done so much in just the JFK assassination and a lot of other things. Welcome to our program, Jim Fetzer.
Thank you, George. It's a real pleasure to be with you again. I've had the benefit of collaborating with the best people to ever study the case, including a world authority on the human brain, who is also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics, who is also an MD and board certified in radiation oncology, which made him an expert in the interpretation of X-rays, a physician who was in trauma room number one when JFK's moribund body was brought in, and then 2 days later was responsible for the care and treatment of his alleged assassin. Another PhD in physics, this time with an expertise in electromagnetism, properties of light, and images of moving objects, and we've been able to discover, really shatter the cover-up by discovering the autopsy x-rays were altered to conceal a fist-sized blowout to the back of the head, that someone else's brain was substituted for that of JFK, and that the Zapruder film has been massively edited and revised to conceal the true causes of death of our 35th president.
Well, I tell you, this has been a very unique conference, and we've got to give Judith Berry Baker a lot of credit. I think she's right over there, in fact, but she's organized and put together what you just spelled out there is phenomenal, is it not? Of speakers with insight into this JFK.
Judith's a wonderful person. Of course, she was Lee's girlfriend in New Orleans the summer before the assassination. She knew a great deal about him. There's been an effort to minimize her, to trivialize her knowledge, because she humanizes the man who's been made out by the government to be the lone demented assassin when he was nothing of the kind. In fact, he appears to have been recruited while he was in Marine Corps basic training in San Diego, where I would subsequently serve as a series commander with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command. He was stationed at Atsugi subsequently, which was our most highly classified base, where he was a radar operator near the altitude of the U-2 flights that were conducting surveillance over the Soviet Union, conducted a pseudo defection at behest of the CIA in order to provide that information to the Soviets, who knew the overflights were taking place but not the altitude and were unable to shoot it down. When a summit was about to take place between Eisenhower and Khrushchev accused the United States of spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denied it, but Khrushchev at that point in time was able to produce the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, and parts of the U-2. Very embarrassing. So instead of a summit that was intended to reduce Cold War tensions, we had an increase by virtue of this embarrassing event. Lee would marry the daughter of a KGB colonel, return to the United States, and be welcomed not as any kind of traitor, but actually by a CIA front organization that gave him money to relocate. He wound up in New Orleans, while Marino wound up in Dallas. In fact, the family with which she stayed had contacts, were able to arrange for Lee when he came to Dallas to have a job at the book depository building, setting him up to play the role of a patsy. While he was in New Orleans, he participated in handing out flyers in support of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which is part of what's known as a sheep-dipping operation to create the false persona of a pro-communist Castro sympathizer that they would then use and exploit when they pegged him for the death of JFK.
Well, I tell you that Lee Harvey Oswald then, was he not connected to the FBI and the CIA in different ways at different times?
Right. He was initially recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence, which has been a black hole for releasing information. His pseudo-defection was at the bequest of the CIA, and as you're astutely observing, Wagoner Carr, the Attorney General of Texas, launched an investigation in the wake of the assassination and discovered immediately that he was working as an informant for the CIA, that he had informant number 179, and that he was being paid $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination, which is why for years and years the government was unwilling to release its W-2 forms. I mean, a simple absurdity, George.
Did he inform on himself, Jim?
Yeah, a simple absurdity until they developed the technology where they could fake it and remove the $200 he was being paid, because otherwise it would be so revealing that he was an unlikely candidate to have performed an assassination. And of course, as you have seen here today, we have pursued a line of research that was initially initiated by Harold Weisberg in his Whitewash series, where Whitewash 2, Photographic Whitewash 1966, reported in the last few pages how the Warren Commission was working very hard with his staff to conceal that Lee Oswald had been in the doorway of the book depository when the motorcade came by. Jim Garrison himself, the celebrated district attorney who brought the lawsuit against Clay Shaw for involvement in the assassination, which he would no doubt have won had it not been for the unfortunate, not really mysterious deaths of his three key witnesses, also believe Lee was in the doorway. Rousen Kay, who is a chiropractor, emphasized to me years ago that the key to the identification was not the face, but the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the t-shirt he was wearing, where by virtue of his background as a chiropractor, he was very used to doing working with people, developing their bodies so their clothes would fit properly, where it turned out that the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the t-shirt were indistinguishable from the man they arrested at the Texas Theater. In fact, they made Lee remove his outer shirt, which was a very richly textured garment that had been made in the Soviet Union, made in Russia, which Marina would eventually acknowledge to Ed Tatro. She'd actually laundered herself so that it wouldn't be so conspicuous that he was the man in the doorway caught in the famous photograph taken by James Ike Alchin, so that he was photographed for his mugshot in a t-shirt. Very, very strange. But the fact is that the Alchin's photograph, which has been tampered with in many ways, has proven to be the key to the solution here, because not only did we have the isolation of Lee as the candidate who fit the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, and the t-shirt, unlike Billy Lovelady, his co-worker, who himself said he thought it was odd they'd be confused because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds lighter, actually substantially more heavy than Lee in that regard, who actually was interviewed by the FBI on the 29th of February, 1964. They asked him to wear the shirt he'd been wearing at the time. He came in wearing a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. They photographed him in the shirt. They wrote to J. Edgar Hoover, including the photographs, that this was the man in the doorway, hoping he would have noticed that in no way, shape, or form could he have been the man they were most interested in, who appears to be leaning out. And what Larry has now done in the wake of all of our further research on this subject, where I've probably published 20 articles on different aspects of this part of the case, is to find suitable photographs and enable him to do overlays. So he's been able to prove through a series of computer-generated GIFs that the man in the doorway also not only had the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the t-shirt that Lee was wearing, but was indeed Lee Oswald, where the facial features fit exactly. And while those of Billy Lovelady do not, and where in addition he's been able to establish that Billy was standing beside Lee with his arms raised, his hands to protect his eyes from the sun. Well, we'd long since noticed that in this part of the Alchins, the There were various photographic anomalies that indicated the photograph had been altered in this region, one being a figure known as Black Tie Man, who's both in front of and behind the doorman figure at the same time, meaning the doorman figure is missing his left shoulder, which, of course, is an anatomical absurdity.
a little photoshopping, right?
It's a bit much, George. In those days, it wasn't very sophisticated, so what they did was very crude. But they also completely whited out the shirt that that the man with his hands elevated was wearing because it was so conspicuous. But Larry has not only established that that was Billy Lovelady, that the doorman was Lee Oswald, but he's reconstructed what the image would have looked like had it been in color at the time, and it's really stunning work. Which, of course, turns out to be the reason why, when they held this mock trial here in Houston, overlapping with the commencement of this conference, they excluded Larry Rivera as a witness because it would have been decisive. His proof would have left no doubt in anyone's mind. They would have had 5 minutes of deliberation and an acquittal of Lee Oswald for complicity in the crime because, given he was in the doorway, he obviously could not have been on the sixth floor shooting at JFK. He cannot have been the lone gunman or even one of the multiple assailants who fired at the president in Dealey Plaza that day.
My gosh, that's devastating. You also introduced earlier today a man's statistical, did a statistical analysis, is that right?
Richard Charnin is a brilliant statistical analyst who's published a book, Reclaiming Science, about the improbability of the number of witnesses who have died odd deaths, just as a purely statistical analysis. Some were homicides, some were suicides, some were heart attacks, some were automobile accidents, and he just was using, you know, a comparison with the normal rate of incidents with which those events would occur in a certain population. And I mean, the improbability of these deaths is simply staggering and overwhelming. He was initially intrigued by this problem when he watched the brilliant film Executive Action, which was released in 1973, starring Burt Lancaster as the very efficient manager who's assisting a figure with a striking resemblance to Clint Murchison Sr., where they're inducing a fellow they refer to as Harold, who's H.L. Hunt, to join them in taking John F. Kennedy out of office, where the film shows that that Harold is initially hesitant, but that as the situation develops, they pile on more and more reasons why JFK needs to be taken out, including that he's going to cut the oil depletion allowance that is an immense tax write-off from which they all benefit. This is very, very well done about the Dallas aspects of the assassination, even though we know that, in fact, it originated when Lyndon Johnson forced himself onto the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960. He wasn't on Bobby or Jack's long list, much less their short. Jack had actually invited Stuart Symington of Missouri to join him on the ticket, but gave him overnight to think about it. When Bobby went by the Johnson suite with a pro forma offer, he never imagined Lyndon would show the least interest and was dumbfounded when he jumped on it. Using information provided by J. Edgar Hoover, he threatened to reveal that JFK had Addison's disease, wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, that his dalliances with beautiful women had included some who were spies for East Germany. And moreover, he added that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposal sent down by the White House would be dead on arrival because he, as the powerful majority leader of the Senate, would bottle them up. Jack and Bobby tried to figure a way out of it, but they were boxed in by LBJ. When one of Lyndon's wealthy supporters learned he would be on the ticket with Jack, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing that now Lyndon would help JFK become president of the United States. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby would subsequently declare in public that JFK would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. Lyndon Johnson would subsequently send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination.
Boy, I tell you what. I mean, just the intrigue and the players and the involved individuals. This had to have the sanctions of the top elite in the world. Europe and America, did it not?
Well, it was principally, it was a U.S. op.
Yes, but I mean, it had to have some of the top money people in the world to help cover it up and keep it going, you know, the cover-up going, I guess.
Well, the importance of the work that I have done is because it is scientific evidence that has shattered the cover-up by discovering, for example, that the autopsy x-rays were altered. You can see a fist-sized blowout to the back of the head, that someone else's brain had been substituted for that of JFK, that the Zapruder film had been massively edited and revised. In fact, I estimate that whereas what we have available today is 487 frames, that 100 frames were removed at the turn from Houston onto Elm because the driver, William Greer, swung out too widely, nearly hit a concrete abutment there, had to hesitate and pull back into line. That would have shaken the confidence of the public in the Secret Service ability to properly protect the president. In fact, that day we have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit. But then there were, after shots had been fired, the driver, Greer again, of course, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure he would be killed. During that period of time, he was hit in the back of the head by a shot fired from the Dow taxi, slumped forward. Jackie, as in backup, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet that set up shock waves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium, where when they impacted Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. What Larry Rivera has also discovered is interviews that were done by Fred Newcomb with the four motorcycle escort officers and their supervisor, Stavis Ellis, to fill in the gaps. Not only did they have to conceal that the limo had been brought to a halt, which was bad enough, that he'd been hit by two shots during that interval, but that Bobby Hargis had dismounted his bike, he'd run in between the two vehicles up toward the grassy knoll from which he believed the shots had been fired, that Officer Douglas Jackson on the opposite side motored up the grassy knoll until his bike fell over and then proceeded on foot, that five agents had dismounted the Secret Service Cadillac and surrounded the presidential limousine, that one of them had taken a chunk of skull from a little boy and thrown it in the back seat. Meanwhile, Clint Hill is rushing up to push Jackie back after climbing out on the trunk after a big chunk of Jack's skull and brains, which he held on her hand all the way to Parkland. Clint Hill lay across the body, so was the first to peer up close and personal into this bloody, gaping, fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head. Obviously a mortal error. In fact, he was dead instantly. Turned and gave his colleagues a thumb down. All of that had to be edited out, so as much as 400 additional frames have been removed to conceal all of that. They consolidated the two hits, but they made the mistake of leaving one frame from 312 to 313 where there's forward motion from the hit to the back of the head, which Josiah Thompson initially had analyzed in his book 6 Seconds in Dallas, published in 1967, which was the most scientific and important part of his book, such that when, as we were approaching the 50th observance, he began disavowing his own work, including its most important part, the double hit theory, I could tell he was setting himself up to renounce the existence of conspiracy and the assassination of JFK. David Lifton, however, meanwhile, had visited Caltech, where the world's most famous physicist, Richard Feynman, was on the faculty with blow-ups of the frames, and Feynman took a ruler and was able to establish independently that JFK had forward motion from 312 to 313 and then violet back into the left, which no one witnessed in Dealey Plaza. In fact, that violet back into the left was because of editing out too many frames. In fact, the camera was running at 24 frames per second, but they took out so many frames it came down to 18.3, which is totally anomalous. I mean, this is a new camera, and there's no reason that would have happened. And the fact is that it was all part of the concealment, which was done by the CIA at a secret lab adjacent to Kodak headquarters in Rochester, New York, known as Hawkeye Works, where Lifton, again, was the first to sort it out, just as he discovered that they'd actually perform alteration to the body including enlarging a simple clean entry wound to the throat into a kind of grotesque-looking mess that might have been the result of an exit wound to the throat, and enlarging the fist-sized blow out to the back of the head, actually taking a cranial saw to the skull of JFK, but in front of two witnesses, believe it or not, one of whom was the mortician, Thomas Evan Robinson, who had prepared the body for the funeral, such that when the Assassination Records Review Board interviewed him and showed him this diagram by J. Thornton Boswell, who'd been assisting Humes with the autopsy, and this dotted line that was indicative of this large missing part of the back of the skull, he said, oh no, the doctors did that he had witnessed with an x-ray tech, the Humes take a saw to the skull to enlarge the wound so that he could claim that the bullet had entered at the base of the skull and come out the top of the skull to remove this huge chunk of the back of the brain, because JFK had been leaning so far forward in order to create a plausible pretext for explaining it as the effect of a shot from behind, which was, of course, a manifest absurdity, and where we now know, especially confirmed by Doug Horn's five-volume Inside the ARRB, that, in fact, it was the same fist-sized blowout to the back of the head when the body arrived at Bethesda, but subsequently altered by Humes himself. It's a stunning story. I mean, it's has so many nicks and crannies and twists and curves that it's hardly surprising, ultimately, that it's been so difficult to crack. I believe that it was because I brought together the best qualified experts to ever study the case, and we went back to reconstruct the medical evidence from the ground up, that we have been able to shatter the cover up and expose what actually happened, because once you separate the authentic from the inauthentic evidence, it's really very straightforward.
Well, at that, boy, that is very insightful and great research that you did on that. That opened up other researchers also, and I believe that C.D. Jackson was head of Time Life at the time, and they're the ones that acquired the Zapruder film. So I guess the alterations of it occurred in there with in their possession, or?
Well, the actual alterations occurred over the weekend. The original was sent to the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C., where they would do blow-ups of these microscopic photographs taken by satellites in space. And that's what you need if you're going to alter a film, the capacity to blow it up so you could change it and then shrink it back down. The original was taken to the NVIC on Saturday, the 23rd, as an 8-millimeter already split film, where the camera functions on a 16-millimeter film, shoots down one half of it called side A, and then you flip it over and you shoot the other side. So it's 16-millimeter split into 2 8-millimeter, where in order to play the whole thing, you'd have to splice it together. And this film had been developed in Dallas. In fact, the NPIC didn't have an 8-millimeter projector, so they had to have a store owner open his shop in order to buy one to even view it. One team was working Saturday. A different team was working Sunday when a 16-millimeter unsplit film was brought from Rochester by a Secret Service agent who identified himself as William Smith, and the exchange was made. Now, Time Life was buying the film on Saturday, but in fact it wasn't in their control until they actually got the copy of the edited version.
So they actually had an edited version by the time they got it.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm relatively convinced that by the time they had the film in their possession, it was already edited, but because it was so poorly done, even though they paid a staggering sum in terms of money, the value of dollars in those days, they never showed it. They never exploited it. They had what many would regard as the most historic footage in history, but they never exploited the fact that they, at that point in time, owned the film. And that was for a very good reason. I mean, Time Life was tied into the CIA.
Well, you know, C.D. Jackson reported to be a CIA.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. In fact,
so that's why they kept it underpublicized or not.
Carl Bernstein in 1977 published in Rolling Stone an article entitled "The CIA and the Media," in which he explained that officials of the agency were boasting that their greatest successes in infiltrating the American media had been with Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS. And in that era, if you controlled Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS, you pretty much had a lock on the American news media, which they've exploited. It's only become worse today. I refer to the New York Times as the Langley newsletter because it's so totally controlled by the CIA.
What would you say about the archives release? What is that going to do? I mean, actually, people like yourself and other researchers have pretty well figured out what happened before this release. Would you agree with that? Or
yes, yes.
That accurate statement?
Yes, yes. Well, it's typical of scholarly research that as you obtain more evidence, new evidence,
it confirms in your previous research.
Or disconfirms, and in this case, it does appear to be confirming. I mean, among the recent releases.
Most of the research
is
confirmed.
That's right. And it does appear to in some rather striking ways. I mean, Larry Rivera is mentioning to me how the release of a very substantial document over 200 pages in length that was outlining how they were going to portray Lee Oswald as having gone to Mexico without his having actually gone. We have long since known that the individual in photographs who was feigning to be Lee Oswald looked nothing like him. In fact, he appears to be someone named Walter Tobinski, who's associated with a crime family in Toronto, Canada. They have the audio tape, and again, it's not Oswald's voice, which led J. Edgar Hoover to issue a memorandum to his agents in charge that someone was in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald, which, in my opinion, if that's all you knew about the assassination, you'd understand it was a conspiracy and that he was being framed all by itself.
What, was not the FBI put out a memo or whatever to their agents about these conspiracy nuts out here that were trying to get into convert the JFK into a conspiracy?
Well, they were trying to figure out how to deal with critics of the Warren Commission.
Yeah, so they tried to misportray them.
In 1964, they issued a memorandum of what you might call talking points for
that's it.
Critics, you would to claim they had nothing new, that they were in it for self-aggrandizement, that they were trying to make money, that everything they were claiming had already been investigated and debunked. It was also introducing the phrase conspiracy theorist so that it was a subtle shifting of the burden of proof that was intended to imply that unless a critic could explain everything that had happened in every detail, they ought not to be taken seriously, which, of course, is a complete reversal of the actual role from the point of view of logic. The critics were falsifying the official account by pointing out aspects in which it was clearly and provably wrong, such as, for example, the backyard photographs.
Oh, man, that was ridiculous, wasn't it?
Right, and as you talk about Life magazine complicity, they put one of these photographs on the cover of Life magazine, which tied up the case in a single package because the figure there, who certainly looks like Lee Oswald, is holding a Mannlicher Carcano. He's got a pistol belt with a revolver with which he's alleged to have shot Officer J.D. Tippett, and he's holding two communist newspapers, The Worker and The Militant. So what they're tying together in the package is a motive and means, and of course, since he was working at the book depository, he had the opportunity. Except that, you know, we've had legendary analysts such as Jack White pointing out that the chin is not Oswald's chin, that there's an insert point, line between the chin and the lower lip. Lee himself said it was his face pasted on someone else's body and that with time he'd be able to prove it because he knew something about photography. Well, we've been able to carry that out even though he was unable to do it himself. The fingertips of the right hand are cut off of the newspapers. If they're used as a standard to determine the height of the individual, as Jack White discerned could be done, lay him off from the bottom of the sole of his foot to the top of his head. Turns out to be too short to be Lee Oswald, only 5'6", whereas Lee was approximately 5'10", which meant either they used someone who was too short to be Lee, or what actually happened, they put the newspapers in a little too large when they fabricated the photograph.
The head was cockeyed too much. It wasn't put onto the shoulders or neck, and it was off a little bit. That's what I spotted immediately. Cockeyed a little bit.
You have these four different photographs, and the face is exactly the same in all four of these photographs, which is an optical impossibility given they're taken at different times and in different positions.
Right,
but in addition, We have discovered, Jim Mars and I, you know, dedicated my presentation here to Jim Mars.
Well, you and him worked together closely.
Well, we did. We authored an article, The Framing of the Patsy, the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, in which we went through the backyard photographs, and we made the points we're making here. We cited Jack White's work and also more recent studies by Judith Very Baker, who turns out herself to be very adept at conducting research. And we concluded that, in fact, the figure who had stood in for Lee Oswald was none other than Roscoe White, who was a Dallas police department officer with ties to the CIA, principally because he was the right height, weight, build, and so forth, but he had a very funny anomaly on his right wrist from having had a broken bone that didn't heal properly. Lawyer Rivera has taken the issue one step further by finding a photograph of Roscoe White standing in just the right posture so he could superimpose it over the Lee Oswald backyard photographs, and it's an exact fit. So, it was Roscoe White to a T, so that during my presentation, I not only presented Larry's definitive work on the man in the doorway having been Lee Oswald and the figure beside him having been Billy Lovelady, but that the backyard photograph had been staged using Roscoe White to stand in for Lee, which really, I think, had a profound impact on the audience observing the evidence as it developed before their very eyes.
Well, what would you say with some concluding remarks, Jim Fetzer? You've done so much, and this particular conference has been so insightful, has it not?
Oh, it's been a terrific conference.
Yes.
And there's much yet to be revealed. For example, in the latest releases, we find it turns out that the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cabell, had joined the CIA in 1956. It took me 10 years to figure out the connection between the CIA and Dallas, and when I discerned it was the brothers, that Earl, the mayor at the time, was a brother of Charles, who was a deputy director of the agency that JFK had dismissed, I realized that Dallas was their backyard, that they knew Dealey Plaza, the perfect location for an ambush. It turns out that another document shows that the Russians in 1965 had concluded that Lyndon Johnson was responsible for the death of John F. Kennedy and wanted their resources to unearth all the information they could possibly about Johnson, but that had been their conclusion. And it's rather intriguing that they recently interviewed me with Paul Craig Roberts, who's our nation's leading public intellectual, for a Russian state television special about the disclosure of the documents, in which they showed special interest in the backyard photographs. So I was very gratified to see at least one government agency take a major role where, just to underline the point, the significance of the research we did, you can eliminate the candidates that have so frequently been advanced because, for example, while the KGB may have had the ability to alter photographs and films, they could not have obtained a copy of the Zapruder to subject it to massive alteration. The Mafia could not have extended its reach into Bethesda Naval Hospital to alter x-rays under control of U.S. medical officers or agents of the Secret Service. Poor anti-Castro Cubans could not have substituted someone else's brain for the brain of JFK. So when you look at the evidence and its impact on the alternative hypotheses about who was responsible, it turns out to be a very narrow and well-defined class, whereas Noel Twyman in his magisterial work, Bloody Treason, of 1997, pointing out that the most perfect conspiracy would have involved combining the resources of the CIA Mafia, which were working together against Castro, the military, the Secret Service, Lyndon Johnson, and J. Edgar Hoover, and that's exactly how it played out.
Well, so the deep state then is still a deep state now, is there?
Sad to say.
Yeah, I mean, some of those players are passed away, but, I mean, the deep state is carrying on. It's a monopoly, isn't it?
Well, no doubt about it. Yeah, behind the scenes, which is why they've been so infuriated with Donald Trump, because he's doing his best to
upset. He's not a player. He's a loose cannon, right?
From their point of view, certainly
he doesn't knuckle under to everything they want.
And it looks as though he may actually be achieving far more than any of us expected.
Right,
as many as 1,800 indictments having come down against the real the parties who were really involved were the Russians, which had nothing to do with Donald Trump and his campaign, but had everything to do with Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, the Foundation, John Podesta, Tony Podesta, Uranium One. Remember, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were given the electric chair for sharing American nuclear secrets, atomic secrets with the Soviet Union. What about Hillary Clinton, who sold off 20% of American uranium supplies to Russia, which was approved even by Barack Hussein Obama? It's a shocking story, and more is to come.
And Uranium One, though, at the time that they were receiving those approvals for the Russians to buy either the initial 19 or controlling interest later, owned two of the most productive mines in Kazakhstan. And that's what I think the Russians were really seeking at the time that they took over Uranium One.
George, that's really fascinating stuff. I think you're more on top of that aspect of the story than am I, which is one more reason I so enjoy having these conversations with you, my friend, because I learn from you, too.
Well, I don't know about that, but you're the researcher and the book writer, and I'm just a small little cog in a great big research. But I'll say this, a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, Eric Samuelson, coined the term conspiracy scholar, and you truly are the top of that group, okay?
Well, George, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that. Yes, yes, yes. I was once asked by WCCO, a major TV station out of Minneapolis, when I was en route to a previous conference of Judith, what I thought about the phrase conspiracy theorist and how I preferred to be described. And I said, well, I think better is conspiracy analyst or conspiracy realist, because
now the word conspiracy scholar.
I like it, George.
I mean,
that
elevates it to a level
I like
of scholarship.
I appreciate it, very much.
Well, thank you very much, Jim Fetzer, for being with us this afternoon. And we certainly appreciate it, and thank you for all your hard research and your insight into these affairs.
My pleasure, George. Thanks for featuring me.
Thank you very much.
That was an interview I had last weekend with Jim Fetzer up in Dallas. And he has like a mind that can remember all these details. And that's what's really good about interviewing Jim Fetzer, is that you get out there in real time a lot of good, detailed information. And he's right on top of these issues in most cases. And so he's really an exquisite master of reporting, you know, and the concerns that he has also. So he has a scientific mind. I think he taught philosophy and critical thinking and logic and so forth on the university level. And so he has a capacity to expound on these different issues, like the JFK assassination, where he can go out there and literally, my gosh, just go on and on with his detail. Now, he brought up Larry Rivera in his interview, and coming up on the next about 10 or 11 minute clip is Larry Rivera, so I just want to set him up here. He's been a researcher extraordinaire also, and he's used like 3D modeling to set up, you know, and we go into this in the interview some, to set up, you know, what Dealey Plaza, everything, the focus here on the JFK assassination is, of course, it's Dealey Plaza. What it looked like at the time of the assassination, where everyone was, what really happened, what really went down there that day, see. So basically, that's what we're talking about, is trying to recapture, or see what I mean, that day of the event, and trying to imagine or project or gather evidence as to who was there, who what they're working for, and so forth. And everyone is under the conclusion now that our largest CIA, FBI, all these top players were there, and these oil men and this and that, and they all had something to gain. So if you look at all the people that had something to gain, those are the people that were in Dealey Plaza. Some were there standing, and they had control and power, powerful takeover of the country, and they were all in cahoots with each other, and they were successful at covering up, you know, under the lies of just a one shooter from behind, and Lee Harvey Oswald did it when it was obvious that there was a neck jerk, even in the Zapruder film. So there was a frontal shot from the very beginning. They just hammer it away. Usually, every 2 or 3 years, they'd hire some underling that would publish some, you know what I mean, propaganda, you know, for the JFK assassination. Then they go out there and just publicize a bunch of lies and everything else. And that's been going on for years. I've been noticing that in my own, you know, work on this. And I've been, you know, reading everything I could, and I pretty well understand that it was the most powerful deep state players that did this. They're still in control out there. They're giving hell. They're giving Trump hell right now. And so we've got to try to expose what's going on right now by talking about the JFK thing. I think that's where it's really a good tool, is when you start beginning to talk about the JFK thing, then you understand, hey, there's a lot going on a real deep level here, see. And the deep state is there all the time, and they pulled off with the mafia and all these other elements. They pulled off the JFK thing and got away with it, and it was murder. And there's debate about the Kennedy brothers, what they had. They had a few problems themselves. So, you know, they're not lily white either. So, but really, this was a president, and it was just an outright assassination, killing of the king. Well, look, we're going to bring up Larry Rivera next, and he did the 3D modeling, and we're going to talk about that. And then I'll finish with some closing comments.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and sitting to my right is Larry Rivera, and he's done quite a bit of work over the years on the JFK assassination. Larry, how long have you been working on in this area?
The assassination itself, or the areas of my expertise? The assassination itself, about 40 years.
Okay, and I know you're into Blender 3D photo analysis. Is that right? Is that one of your specialties that you brought to bear in your research?
Well, Blender is the number one three-dimensional computer graphics imaging software in the world right now, and it's been around since around 2003, and it is a collaborative effort with many programmers around the world, and it's right now used by just about every programmer to do games, to create three-dimensional scenes, compositions, and that kind of thing. What we can do with Blender is create three-dimensional scenes from photographs.
Okay? Oh, okay. And so what you've done is take some of the photographs in Dealey Plaza, right?
Well,
and use this software to enhance on a three-dimensional basis the effects.
That's right. You can go to blender.org and download the program for free. A word of caution, the program has a little bit of a steep learning curve. However, if you go to YouTube and you enter Blender tutorials, you'll be able to find several very good teachers who explain step-by-step how to navigate through Blender, because at first when you first run the program, the interface looks a little bit intimidating, so to speak.
Right. And some of these software packages are that way, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the Blender has replaced what we used to know as in the 80s and 90s as computer-aided design used by architects and engineers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was an architectural tool at one time, and then people have applied it to
It can be used as an architectural tool.
Like 3D rendering of buildings,
exactly.
Walking around them and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
And so what interesting tidbits or details did you come up with?
Well, what we have done is we have created an actual three-dimensional scene of Dealey Plaza.
Okay.
All the buildings, Elm Street, the grassy knoll, the pergola, the triple underpass. And what we're able to do with this model, George, is actually go in there.
Oh, I see. In other words, it's just like the viewer was actually on the ground almost.
That's
and
right.
Could experience almost a three-dimensional real-life time.
Not almost. Time, not almost. Not almost. You do.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And so you relive that scene at that time.
You can go in there.
Minutes. My gosh, that's interesting.
What you do is you set up cameras and you work with objects. And these objects you model.
Okay, oh, okay. Okay.
By using certain functions in Blender, for example, to model an object, we alter faces, edges, and vertices. Okay.
Okay.
And as we model our scene, what we do is we use reference images. Okay. For example, the Robert Cutler map.
Okay.
That many people are familiar with, because Robert Cutler was an architect and he was a first generation JFK researcher, and he actually made the first architectural rendering of Dealey Plaza. And
oh, okay.
What's so important about Robert Cutler is that he did this at a time when Dealey Plaza had not been altered. Okay, a lot of the landmarks are in different positions.
That's
or
right. They've done some
altogether.
Landscaping changes around there.
Absolutely,
haven't they?
Absolutely.
And so it wasn't exactly today. It's not exactly the way it appeared on that day,
right.
November 22nd, 1963.
That's right. That's right. And I'll give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
The lampposts, for example.
Oh, are different places.
That's right. Right now they are at the base of the grassy knoll.
Okay.
Okay. On November 22nd, they were beyond the sidewalk, okay, right at the curb.
Okay.
Okay. Now, why is this important? Well, when you look at the Zapruder film, if you go over there and you try to reenact it, reenact it.
Oh, I see.
The lampposts are not going to fall, in the same place. Okay.
Right.
So
right.
For researchers,
for timing and things like that,
exactly.
Important.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, if with Blender, we can restore that, okay, and show you exactly what it would have looked like, okay, on November the 22nd. I can go on with other examples. For example, the Texas School Book Depository entranceway at the top of the steps on November 22nd only measured 3 feet.
Okay.
It's been remodeled. I believe in the 1980s when the county took over the building, they remodeled the entrance and they pushed that doorway 6 feet inwards.
Oh, okay. Okay.
To now the length now is 9 feet and 2 inches.
Oh. Okay.
And many other examples of, for example, the trees. If you look at the Cutler map, you see a lot more trees in Dealey Plaza than what there are today.
Oh.
Okay. So all these little details are important if people are going to try to go in there in Dealey Plaza and study the actual area and the scene itself. And for example, you can go and study trajectories, possible trajectories. And what we do in Blender.
Well, that's right, where the shooters might have been.
That's right.
And then the limbs and might have been in the way or not, and the trees and so forth.
Well, I'll give you a good example. A lot of people think that the frontal shot came from the grassy knoll.
Right.
And I have to disagree completely. If you go there and you've studied, the trajectory of that shot that came through the windshield and hit JFK in the throat.
Oh, yes, that would be more. Yeah,
at that point, grassy knoll is totally to his right. So that does
yes,
not work.
It wouldn't have been that way. We'd been more in front of
exactly,
the limousine.
Exactly.
Maybe
so,
from above where the railroad tracks were or someone.
Not from above, but from below.
Below.
On
at
Commerce.
A lower.
That's right.
Trajectory.
At Commerce, at the curb there, where if you go, it's what we call a cubbyhole.
Right.
There is an area where there's a sidewalk and there is a column and holes, that go all the way through the underpass.
Yes, yes.
Which provide a perfect cover.
I see. Hidden away in a dark place.
Exactly.
And then they could have fired. And
if you go there, and you look at the cars as they come at you.
Right.
Okay. You will see that the cars are completely stationary for about 3 or 4 seconds because they're coming right at you.
What there has been speculation.
Which would have been a slam.
Did the limousine actually stop or not?
Oh yeah.
Actually, isn't that what the Zapruder film was edited for?
The
keep that out of the public knowledge. Yeah. And they came around that corner and slowed way down. Is that true, too? Yeah. Because they needed a target that was real slow-moving, and then it did stop momentarily.
Well, I'll give an example of how Blender confirms how fast the limousine motorcade was going.
Right.
If you look at the Alton's photograph, you see the angle of what's presented in the photograph, okay? Well, in Blender, in order to get that same angle, the only way to do it is by placing Alton's in the middle of Elm Street. I mean, in the middle of the left lane of Elm Street.
Okay.
Which means that if he was on the street, you know, he was confident enough to be there, knowing that the motorcade was coming slow enough that the motorcycles weren't going to run him over.
Right. Well, in fact, they were told not to go past the rear wheel or something. Was that?
Those are the motorcycle police
were told to stay back.
Those are the escort.
And usually there was a media flatbed truck that preceded the limousine and had film and stuff moving.
It should have been, but it wasn't.
That was not there.
They didn't want that.
That was sent
all the way to the back of the motorcade.
Right.
But they
structured the thing, the people that planned it.
So to get back to my point about Blender, it's a very useful tool for researchers.
On this 3D Blender, can you put the sun in there?
Thank you,
that's important. The shadows at the time.
Thank you. That's important.
Like Rembrandt was a master of lighting in his paintings.
That's right.
And so reconstructing this through Blender,
you hit the nail right on the head, George, because in order to create the shadows that we see in the Zapruder film and in the Alton's photograph, we have to position the sun to reflect, to create those shadows onto the street, onto the grass.
I see.
Okay, and as we continue to create our rendering, our scene, we're able to position the sun create those shadows and actually replicate the whole scene as it was at 12:30 p.m. on November 22nd, 1963.
My gosh. Larry, you've really done a great service in rendering this in a whole new way that others had never thought about.
Thank you, George. I want to just recommend if you're going to get into Blender, there's one really, really good teacher on YouTube. His name is Blender Guru. And you go to YouTube and search for Blender Guru, Andrew Price. He's an Australian. And as far as I'm concerned, he is the best. And
do you have some of this on a website now, yourself, some of your work?
Yes. Okay, I have it on my blog.
Give us that.
On my blog is merdist, merdist.com/WP for WordPress.
Okay.
And you'll be able to see some of the stuff that we've been able to do with Blender there.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being with us here, Larry Rear. And Lord, thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you,
in the JFK.
Oh, it's always a pleasure,
George.
You're
one of the lead researchers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Too kind. Thank you.
Sir. There you have it for hour two. We started off with Jim Fetzer, ended with Larry Rivera. And hour one was Andrew Craig and Hubie Clark, the Honor Guards members. We can beat a horse to death, on the JFK thing. Some people say, well, it's so far back there. You know, your pragmatist would say, oh, it's so far back there that what good is it finding out anything? Well, we're finding out really who's still in control of this country. That's what we're finding out, and that's what we need to be, teaching and bringing forward to the public at large. We've got to try with all our might to try to overcome this tyranny that is, it's a scientific dictatorship what we're up against. I mean, this thing is not, this is a really a beast that has been built. And it has been building since the national security state started in 47, I guess, and so forth. And before that, they had the military, secret, army units and naval. Naval has been, that's been really the core of much of this. So, what do we do? We're gonna do this, and we're going to go to Dallas. And Judith Berry Baker is going to get up there and you know, cry over Lee Harvey Oswald, which she has a right to do. But in her work about proving who she was and then revealing what Lee was about, it opens up so much more, see, to the public at large as to what was really going on in New Orleans. What kind of government did we have at the time? Oh, there were people that were, you know, suggesting that we go bomb our own commercial planes and blame it on the Cubans. See, I think we should have opened up Cuba before we did. See, we should have opened up trade with them a long time. It would have brought them over to a open market system, and it would have saved a lot of hungry mouths from probably starving. Who knows? But trade and business is not bad for anyone. My impressions of the conference up there was that it's focused in this year, and I've been to several, and quite a few researchers were there, and most of them had written books, and most of them had done very, very scientific, work, and some were world authorities. Sarah Wick, he's a pathologist, a forensic pathologist, and he's known all over the world for his work and his expertise. So there were people, you know, like that, and there were people there that attended that want to know more about it. They're just very, very interested citizens. And so, and then this year we're missing Jim Morris is gone. He passed away a few months ago. So he's no longer with us, and he was always with us up there. And so we miss him dearly, because he was a big part of this, the JFK. And he was from that area up there in Fort Worth, going to school up there, and was starting to report police. He was a police reporter, I think. After the JFK, got out of school, and he became a police reporter. But there have been a lot of people interested in this. And then all of a sudden, I think I brought up the point with Fetzer where they started calling everybody conspiracy nuts, see? That's a good way to discredit people that are trying to really find the truth about these matters. No, we're not conspiracy nuts. We're conspiracy scholars, if anything. And a good friend of mine, he's gone now, Eric Samuelson, coined that term, and God bless him for coming up with stuff like that, you know. He dig down deep. He started putting up stuff all over this world of different lists, the Bilderberg list, the Skull and Bones list, and all those lists. These men out there at the top of this power structure, and women, they tend to be psychopaths because they have no conscience at all. So that's why they could do some of those that participated in the JFK. They have no, conscience on this at all. And they just, look back, well, it's something we had to do, to maintain power, and then they could find every bad reason, to get rid of JFK, if they could. But the psychology of men, especially, in this state that men find themselves, they're driven by sexual desires. And look at this just scandalous going on here lately with all these men abusing women like they have. I mean, men have some real problems. And that's why over the years I brought up what I call the man problem. And the man problem is very simple. It's big egos. And they go out and do things they shouldn't do. And it's all about me, And that's not good. And they never quite overcome that, They just don't get it, really. And they try, they think they are getting it, but they don't. Because to see oneself, you've got to almost begin to see oneself from outside of your mind and look back at yourself. And then you've got to start observing. Self-observation is all important. And it's really not easy to do. I want to thank everybody out there for listening tonight. And come in and click off on those different sites and buy those books at these very, very dedicated authors have written. But thank you, and God bless everyone. Have a great Thanksgiving.